Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thank you so much for joining us. We come your way Mondays at 7 a.m. and p.m. That's Sundays at 7 a.m. and p.m., Mondays at 1 a.m. We stream live at richarddugan.com. We are also archiving these programs at richarddugan.com, the radio shows page. We also link to our guests. We'll be giving you the link to our guest in just a couple of moments. We encourage you to go to their website, see what they have to offer. If it resonates with you, please follow up on it. Go forward, and I would love to hear what you have found and find what has worked for you. I'd like to know what hasn't worked for you too. Maybe we have some other suggestions. Again, it's all about giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true as we look for those new paradigms for a new world, those new ways of living. So please, please avail yourselves of all of the information that is available to you. And I couldn't encourage you to do that more. It's the information that our guests provide is just, quite honestly, it's quite incredible, and today is no exception. We're going to help you get your mindfulness practice on track with the author of Why Can't I Meditate? The question is, why can't I meditate? Because I'm just a big whiner, and I don't know. But I'll tell you, meditation for me has not come. I was going to say it's not come easy. No, it hasn't come. I just haven't found... I haven't made the time and the space. I know people, they're scheduled out the wazoo, as it were, in terms of making time for yoga or for meditation or whatever the things that are important to them. But I've also taken the tack from one of the great saints down through the ages who has said that God is amongst the pots and the pans. Well, we're going to compare notes with our guest, Nigel Wellings, all the way from the UK. And Nigel, thank you so much for joining us on the program today.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Obviously, meditation, it seems to me, just from the title, was a struggle for you. Am I correct in assessing that from the title?
Not just was, continues to be.
I don't feel so bad now.
We all write books about the things that we're no good at.
Well, let's, because we've talked about this subject, meditation, a lot, but not so much from this aspect of mindfulness. Now, let's define what that is, because I keep hearing the term, but I'm not clear as to what that means, mindfulness.
It's not surprising that you're not that clear, because there are actually lots and lots of different definitions going around at the moment. So Buddhism, which is the home of mindfulness, gives us one understanding. And then, of course, we have secular mindfulness now, very much being put forward in your country by Jon Kabat-Zinn, mindfulness-based stress reduction, which gives us a secular version of the same thing. But to find a kind of a really simple starting point, we all have the ability to rest our attention on something. So if we choose to rest it, say, on the sensations of our breath and just leave it there, after a couple of minutes, we're going to find that we become distracted. And then we just simply recognize that and bring our attention back to the breath again. So maybe if we do this for 10 minutes, we are distracted, I don't know, 100 times. But slowly, 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 by leading our attention back again, back again, back again, a bit like training a puppy, our concentration begins to grow and a certain calm and a certain kind of insight begins to grow out of that experience.
It sounds like you're describing, say, the zone that especially sports athletes get into, and they're not always into that zone when they play every single game or run every single race, etc. It kind of comes and goes. Is that a fair analogy?
It may be, but it's got a little bit of a problem, because one of the things about mindfulness is that we're letting go of an ambition to achieve any particular state of experience, state of mind. Mm-hmm. So really what we're after is an ability to accept whatever state of mind we've got So whether we're very agitated or sleepy, whether we're having all sorts of malicious thoughts, or whether we're having very sublime ones, mindfulness is a bit like a mirror which just lets all those things come and go within it. So the essence of it is something to do with equanimity rather than changing one experience for another one that we think is better or feel is better. So yeah, the zone can be, we can be mindful of the zone, but we can also be mindful of the zone not being there.
Right. So we're really working, in a manner of speaking, to set the, not push, but set the ego aside and set the outside world aside. Am I getting it close?
Except if we were trying to set something aside, that again would be implying that we're trying to change something for something else. It's not easy, is it? It's about acceptance. The big word in all of this is acceptance. It's being able to sit down and accept that after 5 minutes, my bum hurts, my knees hurt, I'm bored, this is tedious. I want to get up and have a look inside of the fridge or do my emails. And just carry on noticing that I'm distracted and bringing myself back, noticing I'm distracted, bringing myself back, and then just staying there. So with that acceptance, we learn to welcome every single part of our experience, something which is actually quite difficult to do.
You and I, we have sort of grown up in the Western culture for the most part, right? I mean,
yes.
You've grown up in the city there in the UK with all of the modern conveniences. And these practices are not, first of all, not really taught unless you search for them now. But they're not taught to us as we're growing up. Are you seeing that that's starting to change, or has it been changing over the last 5 or 10 or 15 years?
It's been changing over the last 5. I don't know about you in the States, but here we have several programs which take mindfulness into schools. They're called Dot B, and they teach children how to, I wouldn't exactly call them mindfulness, but they're certainly the roots of mindfulness, the attentional training, which brings a kind of a stillness and a bit of calm. So, yeah, it's beginning to grow here in that respect.
What about, and in that regard, talking to, about children, do you find that the young people, children, single digits and into their teens, do they seem to come to it somewhat naturally, that they'll get the initial guidance, but then it's like, boy, they take it and, so to speak, euphemistically, mind you, run with it?
I don't know, actually, to tell you the truth, because I'm not taught any children. The one thing which is really interesting about mindfulness is that it's exciting everybody at the moment. I mean, the fact that I'm on this program with you is evidence of that. But we've been teaching mindfulness now in Bath, in England, for 10 years. It's our 10-year anniversary. I think we were the first people teaching that in this area. And so we've had maybe, I don't know, between 600 and 700 people go through our courses. Now, of those 600 and 700, I think I could probably count on 2 hands the people who've come away at the end of the course dissatisfied, unhappy with the experience. So that's a tiny percentage. But again, if I go back to all the people that have finished, I think it's also a tiny percentage of people who keep it going, keep the mindfulness meditation practice going on a daily basis once the course is finished. And so my book, Why Can't I Meditate? How to Get Your Mindfulness Practice on Track, is really addressed to those of us who have had a go at mindfulness. We still think it's a really good idea. We'd like to do some more of it, but there's just something which is getting in the way and stopping us doing it. And I would say that that is probably the majority of the people who learn mindfulness, whether it be from a secular course like those of our own, mm-hmm. or from mm-hmm. a Buddhist one. You know, I met so many Buddhists over the last 40 years say, I love meditating, but I just don't ever do it. I feel so guilty.
Well, I know that for me, and again, we talk about meditation all the time on this program, and I have to freely admit each time that, I don't have a practice. The joke about, doctors, for example, yes, I'm in practice. Okay, well, when are you going to finish practicing and start doing kind of thing? And it's just humorous, but there is a certain level of frustration because I'm aware of people who have that regular practice. They're very diligent about it. They're not, it's not like, and if they miss a day, they'll beat themselves up. This is just part of, it's almost for them, it's as easy as just breathing. I mean, they don't even have to think about it. Oh, it's my time for meditation. Pardon me. I must close this meeting or conversation and go meditate. And off they go. And they do this, and it's just part of their lives. But then the rest of us, as you've described, we struggle with it. And to me, there lies the paradox in that meditation in and of itself is supposed to help us to, to relax and to center and to listen, especially to the still small voice. But if we're struggling to find the time to do that, again, you have all of those distractions that continue to harangue us. And back in the 60s in particular, there were people who they left everything to go, as the phrase was, to go find themselves. They would travel around the world to try to find themselves when, in fact, they didn't have to go anywhere. It was all within them. And that's sort of what meditation, that's what I'm hearing that meditation is now. How about from your perspective, your definition, if you will, or even in your own personal experience of meditation as you have seen it?
I was one of those people who traveled around the world looking for myself. I've still not found me, so I hope there's a bit of time left. I think those people you describe who jump up and say, okay, it's my time for my meditation, they may have cracked it in the sense that they've achieved what I would call a meditation habit, where they don't think about whether they would like to meditate or not. It's not based on their emotional state at any one time. They just do it more like cleaning their teeth. Mm. And that's a big secret. That is one of the first milestones in the road. Give up doing your meditation because you feel like it and start doing it because it's just like cleaning your teeth. Whether you feel like it or not, just do it. Now, that, of course, takes an enormous burden off our shoulders immediately, doesn't it? Because it takes the burden off, should I do it now or should I not? What do I feel like? Is it a good time? All that kind of stuff just disappears. We just do it, and that's it. There's no argument. It also takes the burden off the meditation of being a particular type of meditation. It doesn't have to be a good time to meditate because I think I'm going to have a good experience. It just happens to be the time that I do meditate, and whatever experience I have, that's just fine. Okay. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of getting the discipline, the shape of the practice. But I would guess that the people who you're talking about who just go off and do it like this, when they're actually sitting down on their seat or on their cushion, whatever they look like from the outside, they, and this is certainly my experience, are having all sorts of different types of experience. So one day, yeah, it will be kind of calming and there'll be a lovely stillness to it. And then the next day I'll be worrying about getting the tires fixed on my car, whether I can afford it. The next day I'll be thinking about the kids. The next day I'll have another nice chilled practice. And so it goes on like that. But as I say, once we begin to drop the ambition to have a specific sort of experience and are happy to have whatever experience presents itself, then we're beginning to go on to the next level of the practice, which is the ability to have an acceptance of whatever experience we have, whether it's good or bad or mad or sad, whatever it is, it's just fine. And of course, once we get to that place, it doesn't matter what happens in our meditation. It doesn't matter how bad a meditator I am, because I'm just going to sit there and be with whatever person I find myself I am on that day, in that minute.
You also have what I will refer to as the five dwarfs, as opposed to the seven, which are grabby, grumpy, sleepy, jumpy, and maybe. These are kind of the distractions, or the we'll call them the distraction personalities of sort within us that makes meditation or can make meditation a challenge, right?
Does make meditation a challenge for every single one of us. No one's exempt from this little crowd. Yeah, I mean, that's great that you've just come in there with that. So when I'm saying that we sit down and accept whatever comes up in our practice and our meditation experience, that's who most of us meet most of the time. So what are they? They're grabby, grumpy, sleepy, jumpy, and maybe. And they represent what Buddhism calls the five hindrances to calming the mind. So the first one is wanting a particular experience. The second one is not wanting a particular experience. So that's wanting and not wanting. Second pair are, and everybody who tries to practice meditation knows this one, sleepy. The original words are wonderful, sloth and torpor. Not being able to keep our eyes open, our head nodding, falling over, desperately wishing to lay down and sleep, even though we've just got up after a night's sleep. And then the pair with that is agitation, anxiety, worry, which feels like our mind is just full of, I don't know, mice, rabbits, monkeys, all jumping around, monkey mind.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then the last one, doubt, is doubt. And that's the one which comes in often very much at the end, which says, oh, I'm sitting here, I've been doing this for half an hour, I'm not getting anywhere, this is boring, it's a waste of time, I don't know why I paid all that money for that wretched course, I'm going to get up and do something different.
Well, now, as a psychoanalytic psychotherapist, which is quite a mouthful to say the very least, you also teach the Bath and Bristol mindfulness courses. Let's get a little background on that, because I'm not familiar with those specific courses in regards to mindfulness.
Okay, so that's a little bit of a muddle there. So I'm a psychotherapist, a psychoanalytic psychotherapist. I've been practicing that for, I don't know, maybe 30 years, maybe a bit more. And during the course of that time as a psychotherapist, I gradually became more aware of Buddhism as something that can actually impact and inform psychotherapy. That was in the late 90s. I began to make sense of that. And it was, I think, in 1998 that I first began to teach psychotherapy students how to practice mindfulness. That was my first experience of mindfulness teaching to psychotherapists, so that they could use mindfulness within their psychotherapeutic practice. And then kind of shoot forward to 2006, as I said, it's 10 years now. And then we started teaching mindfulness, not to psychotherapists, but to the general public, through the vehicle of the Bath and Bristol mindfulness courses. And those mindfulness courses are a combination of your mindfulness-based stress reduction programs and what we have over here, which is mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. So it's a kind of marriage. And those we've been teaching for the last 10 years to the general public. I'm really excited about mindfulness as a psychotherapist, because it seems to me that the ability to marry psychotherapy and mindfulness together has been the greatest, I can hardly say this, discovery, revelation of my own private and professional life, particularly the ability to become mindful of our emotions and know how to be with our emotions in a mindfully skillful way. I think that's the biggest discovery I've had.
Fascinating. I'm just really intrigued by all of this, because my background, and as far as just general knowledge of metaphysics and spirituality and the various aspects of the human being beyond the physical, is is just dealing primarily with, I had an upbringing as far as Paramahansa Yogananda and the Autobiography of a Yogi, which was, I consider my metaphysical primer. But I also studied going through these personal growth programs. I'm sure you're familiar with the programs like EST and so forth. Well, I didn't go through that. I went through another one called LifeSpring. But I also, in the late 80s and into the 90s, was able to sort of study with, in a manner of speaking, but again, these were these kind of group personal growth and development programs, these intensive weekend kind of things. Studying the ancient wisdom teachings from all different realms, but with a focus on Desjardins and the zero point and all these different aspects, but then incorporating so much more. I mean, it was like, yes, this is where the founder started from, but then just kept drawing in more and more from so many different sources, which I absolutely loved because it was rare, if ever, that he would find any kind of contradiction in what he was researching and then sharing with us as we went along. And we are not talking about the founder of any kind of faith-based spiritual system or ism. He was just wanting to share this with people. He just wanted to help people to sort of get beyond a lot of their traumas, a lot of their issues, so that they could go on and really live the life that they were given and live it on purpose, live their purpose, which is kind of what we're trying to do here on this program, is share that with people that, hey, there are ways that you can get beyond a lot of that, the muck and the mire that you have unfortunately had to gather, or that you've gathered over the course of your lifetime, especially from childhood. And I remember going through the 80s and the 90s and the different phases in philosophy of psychology that we went through. First, it was, you know, it's your mother and father's fault that you're the way that you are. So we blamed mom and dad, and we blamed our siblings, and we blamed our schoolmates. And then in the 90s, we began to start taking take responsibility for why we are the way that we are. It's not someone else's fault, and it's not our fault. It's just the experiences that we had and the reactions that we had to them. So now here we are in the second decade of the 21st century, and I actually thought that we would be so much further along, both in a material sense as well as we would have gotten beyond bullying. I couldn't believe, specifically in the 90s when I started hearing that come up again, because I went through it in the 60s and 70s, and I'm going, what, we're still dealing with this? Really? Well, because none of this stuff really goes away until we choose to say enough is enough and this is not the path we're going down. So I'm curious, having said all that, how your practice and your initiating people, in a manner of speaking, I don't mean that literally, into this whole aspect of meditation and mindfulness, the mindfulness practice, how this can now help us. Both you and I, we're now in the second half of our lives. I'm 56 now, and
62,
and very excited about that. Matter of fact, I just found a cassette tape, and if you don't know what that is, Google it. Where I interviewed my great grandmother, who lived to be 100, but at the time I interviewed her, she was 95. And it goes back to 1989, and I happened to listen to that, and I have that up on a web page, along with an interview of my parents that I conducted back in August of 2015. And I found it fascinating in both instances where neither of them, they weren't into blaming. They're, certainly, for the most part, they were just sharing experiences and stories. But they came from a place. And my grandmother, great-grandmother, of course, 95, and my parents in their mid-80s, my dad, 85, where these were just experiences that they had. They weren't blaming anybody. They weren't coming from that stuck place that everything that they experienced, Nigel, that's just what they experienced. That was life. And that's how they look at it today. Are we seeing our future generations, are we seeing them as coming into this world and living into this world less encumbered, more encumbered, the same, to where they still have to work through a lot of this stuff before they can get to that place where they can really live on purpose?
Oh, what a question. Yeah, I would say yes. I would say every single one of us has to find a way to be present with the emotions that spontaneously arise within us, many of them incredibly troubling, many of them compulsive, many of them not only hurting ourselves and others, but also others. Each of us has to find a way to work with those emotions. We come in with the ability to work with them, but there's no guarantee that we're going to. On the other hand, this is the very first time in the history of mankind that, for instance, all the different schools of Buddhism are available to any one person. That's never, ever happened before. And so there's an enormous amount of help, support, assistance available to us from many, many sources, including the ones that you've just described, which is fantastic. But what do we say? You can take a horse to water, but you can't make it drink.
Mm-hmm. This is true. So before we go to break here, I want to remind our listeners that we are talking with Nigel Wellings, and he is the author of Why Can't I Meditate? How to Get Your Mindfulness Practice on Track. We encourage you to check out. Actually, there are a couple of websites that you're going to want to check out. One of them is mindfulness-psychotherapy.co.uk. That's one of them. Another one is bath-bristol-mindfulness-courses.co.uk. And let me guess, is there a website titled whycan'timeditate.com or .co.uk?
.com.
Oh, it is? A trick
and
one.
There's no apostrophe and there's no question mark in that.
All right, so it's
doesn't do that kind of stuff. It's just straight. Why can't I meditate? All lowercase .com.
Leave out the special characters, folks. And when we come back, we're going to discuss further with Nigel Wellings about this whole aspect of mindfulness, a big subject these days, about living on purpose and about moving forward in our lives. And we are going to move forward to a break, and we'll be back in just a moment. This is Tell Me Your Story: New Paradigms for a New World.
Stories, I'll do my best to understand you.
And welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Looking for those new ways of living, and we're doing that by giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true, to do the things that you want to do in your life, to live your life on purpose, to thrive. It's one of the things that we, I like to use that term, thrive, Nigel, because I think that most of us are tired of just surviving. It's really, I'm going to put it in this context, Nigel, it's getting annoying. It really is getting annoying that all we can do is just live, and I'm sure this goes on in the UK as well, live from paycheck to paycheck and struggle, and we get into debt, and we have this and that and the other happen, and I think that's one of the reasons why learning to meditate, learning to find that quiet space and place, it can be so freeing, I think is maybe that is the proper word, would you say? Liberating?
Finding a place of equanimity and
ooh,
acceptance.
I like that. I like
is
that.
Incredibly freeing and liberating. You like the word equanimity, so do I.
I do indeed. I also find it interesting, and I don't know about you, but I did an interesting little search on this. Well, not so much of a search, but I pondered this. You know, in our Declaration of Independence, it talks about how we have the right to life and to liberty, okay?
Yeah.
But we don't have the right to happiness. What we do have the right to is pursue happiness. And I find that an interesting distinction. Okay? It's like, well, wait a minute. Why don't we have the right to happiness? Why didn't you put that in there? Because it seemed as though from my observations, that when we look at the history of the Revolutionary War in this country, they were fighting for and trying to attain life and as well as liberty, you know, the freedom to do the things that they wanted to do, right? And yet when it comes to happiness, and I will even put a different twist on that word, I mean, because we could actually use, you know, pursue bliss, to pursue joy, to pursue thriving in our lives. It, to me, that's kind of all of the same thing. That's something that we have to struggle and fight for and so forth, you know, to try to find. And happiness, and I know you're familiar with the happiness index that, what is it? I can't remember the name of the country.
Bhutan.
Bhutan. Thank you. Thank you. Bhutan still has that, and which is great. I love that fact. What about that? Let's talk a little bit about that in terms of whether we talk about life and liberty, but let's talk about, and we can use it in a broad sense, the word happiness or whatever word would fill that gap when it comes to post-meditative, shall we say, posture, emotional, mental, spiritual posture.
Gosh, you said so much there. I'm just trying to take it all on board. I think your founding fathers were wise, actually. I think we can pursue happiness, but there is absolutely no way that we can force happiness out of any circumstance so that we can then experience it. As you know, I've been practicing psychotherapy for a long time. And I've noticed that people who explicitly actually even pursue happiness for themselves are often the ones who are least likely to find it, let alone those who think, well, I've got a right to be happy. Why aren't I? For me, I think actually happiness arises from forgetting about happiness and doing things which create meaning and goodness. I'm going to go for that. Goodness in a world, in our world around us. And then happiness can kind of creep up from behind and permeate in a sort of secret kind of way. Bhutan's a lovely country. I've been there a number of times. They don't have a pursuit of happiness as such, but they just judge things upon how much happiness actions, decisions create for the majority of the people in the country. And so they don't rush out, you know, trying to have a good time. What they do is stuff like making sure they've got all their tree cover and that the gap between the people who have a lot and the people who have much less isn't that big. And by looking after their culture, not trashing it in the pursuit of kind of flashy things. I think only television's just got in recently. And by having a shared identity, which everybody contributes to, rather than following the pursuit of individual narcissistic goals. So you can see that those kind of things, at least I can see, that those kind of things certainly create happiness without happiness being pursued, and certainly nobody sitting there in a strop saying, where's my happiness? I haven't got it yet.
Well, I know that in this country in particular, you know, we're always trying to find that thing that will make us happy or bring us happiness. And yet all of the ancient wisdom teachings teach that that isn't the way that you get to happiness. That is not where you get to joy or bliss or what have you. It's not from the outside in. It's from the inside out, as you basically have described. And I'm wanting for you also to share with us, through the process of meditation, can we, from what I'm hearing you speak of, can we shift our mental and emotional perspective? Can meditation help us to do that?
Yes, it can. So, if there's one thing that I would like people to come out of our courses with, is the ability to be mindfully present with the feeling of their emotions within their body. So let's just unpack that a bit. So an easy place to start is if we think about when we've been in love, perhaps, where do we feel that in love feeling in our body? We generally feel it in our chest, in our heart. When we feel frightened, where do we feel that in our body? We feel it around our solar plexus, where the adrenal glands are. When we feel choked up with emotion we can't express, where do we feel that? We feel it in the throat. So the message there is really clear. Our body is synonymous. It is the same as our emotions. Our emotions and our body are intimately linked. Now, if we can begin to recognize our emotions as what I would call a felt sense, that's a borrowed term, the sensations of our emotions in our body, and then just simply rest our attention on that, allow that sensation to be there without falling into a whole storyline about it. So it's just staying with the sensation, not all the thoughts and all the ideas and stories around it. Maybe just breathe around it. What we begin to notice is that we increase our ability to be present with whatever emotion arises within us without picking and choosing. Now, that creates the most enormous freedom, because if we begin to do this, we begin to realize that there are many emotions that we're not actually allowing ourselves to go close to because they frighten us or they feel too disturbing. So we're kind of closing ourselves down, erecting fences against whole portions of ourselves. Now, by becoming mindfully present with our emotions, felt in our body, we begin to take down those partitions, begin to open and welcome in, to befriend the entirety, the entire range of our emotional experience. And in that, there's an incredible freedom. And of course, it has an impact on the people around us. Many of us, when we don't like a particular set of emotions, will project them into another group of people or another person and say, oh, this is a terrible person, we've got to get rid of them. And what we're really trying to do is get rid of part of ourselves. It creates wars, it creates discord, it creates an enormous amount of unhappiness. So by taking responsibility, you were talking about that earlier on, for our entire spectrum of emotions, allowing ourselves to be present with them, accepting them happily with equanimity, we can begin to stop doing all this kind of picking and choosing, making it other people's fault, creating all this strife. That would be a fantastic thing to come out with. Yeah, that's what I'm after.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. And certainly, as you've heard, that's what we're after as well. One of the thoughts that I've had over the last few years in particular, in spite of the fact that, you know, my father, he's 85, I'm 56, he's been here almost double the length of time that I have, and I'm frustrated over the way things are in this world and the systems that sort of seem to keep us bound. But one of the things that I've kind of held on to, Nigel, is a different perspective of the way things are that seems to let me know that, okay, first of all, there's nothing I can do here in this country. I don't know what the taxation board is called in your country, but here it's the IRS. Nothing I can do about that. Not a thing.
Here it's called pain in the butt.
Well, that's one phrase here as well. But the thing is that I live here in Santa Barbara, California, and I never expected to. I always wanted to get to the ocean, but I mean, there's thousands and thousands of miles of coastline that I could have chosen, and I'm here. Quite remarkable by pretty much any standard. And yet I'm also able to do a lot of the things like this radio program that you are on today. And when I start looking at, and I guess maybe the term is start being grateful for those things that I do enjoy, that I have fun at, that I can look at and say, wow, this is really cool. A matter of fact, what was it? Just the other day, as my wife and I were going outside to get into our car, and we live in a rural area, a deer, and we're talking a big one, walked across, started galloping across of the road that leads up to the driveway to the cottage that we live in. This was a big deer. I would not want to come up on it by myself. Where and the feeling of being close to the natural world in that sense, for me, that's huge. There's no fear there. Hell, I've been within 30 or 40 feet of a big brown bear twice up on the hill where we live. And there was no fear. It was exciting to be in proximity. And my perspective at that time was, well, first of all, if I don't bother him, he won't bother me. He's eating anyway. So if I just let him eat, I go about my business and I go back to the house, no problem. And there was none. But being grateful for all of the various, even little things that are in my life, I don't care about the IRS. I don't care about Franchise Tax Board, which is the California state equivalent. It doesn't matter about all of the other stuff. Look at all of the incredible things that are in my life. And that I have the freedom. And you know what? In any country and under any system, people have the freedom to meditate. It doesn't matter what the government says. How are they going to know if you're meditating or not? Because meditation doesn't take on a posture. What do you think about that?
Meditation doesn't take on a posture. Yeah, I mean, there are lots of, there were hundreds of thousands of Tibetan Buddhists imprisoned by the Chinese in effectively gulag prison camps where they were forbidden to practice meditation after the Cultural Revolution and the invasion of Tibet. And of course they carried on practicing. They just didn't make it obvious because it's something that goes on in our mind. The story with the bear, that makes me think, I'm going to go slightly contrary here.
Okay.
Go at it at a bleak angle. Of course it was wonderful coming across the bear and the deer, and there are many, many experiences in our lives. And two things pop out in response to that. One, you have a neuroscientist called Rick Hansen in your country, and he's written a book called Hardwiring the Good. And I think this is a fantastic title because mindfulness can quite often get linked up to dealing with what we would call the bad or the unpleasant or painful experiences in our life. But of course, we can be mindfully present with good things as well. The only thing is that many of us actually have got quite an aversion to experiencing good things. And so, you know, something comes along like the bear or the deer or a beautiful sky, and we go, wow, look at that bear. And then we just immediately move on in ourselves to something else. So there's no kind of pausing and savoring and being present with and really experiencing the emotions that arise in response to that context. So what Rick Hansen has done is he's done research and he's discovered that we need to actually sit and savor for just something over a minute, mindfully, good experiences so that we really let them in. And let them begin to create neural pathways which begin to build up into something interesting and serious. So that's the first response. Mindfulness isn't just about bad experiences, it's also about good experiences. But many of us actually don't really let ourselves take in the good, and that by slowing down, really being present with it, feeling it in our body, what's the emotion, feeling it in my body, we begin to create a much kind of happier neural network. That's one. The second one again takes us back to making certain types of experience better than other types of experience. And here I've got a funny story. It's kind of cruel but funny at the same time. So one of our students on one of the courses was going off to Portugal on holiday immediately after the course finished. And she said on the last night, "I'm so looking forward to going on holiday. There's this wonderful long white beach in Portugal where there's hardly anybody there. I'm going to go down there one morning. I'm going to put out my towel. I'm going to sit on my towel and have this wonderful mindfulness experience." You can hear the problems already, can't you? So she sits herself down. She's all ready for this wonderful experience, and her mind goes berserk. She starts thinking about her husband and her kids and what a pain in the butt they are. And then she's got, you know, the sand on her towel. It's kind of getting in her shirt. It's really uncomfortable. So she comes back, and I happen to see her in the supermarket a couple of days later. And I say, "How did the mindfulness meditation on the beach go? Because I'm kind of suspicious." And she says, "It was hell. It was absolutely awful. I had a terrible time." And then she explains all the stuff I've just said. And I laugh and I say, "Well, actually, you had the most perfect opportunity for mindfulness there, because you could have been mindfully present with all those intense emotions that arose within you because you weren't getting the type of meditation you thought you should get or wanted."
Well, let me ask you before we let you go, first of all, to give us that website one more time. If I'm not mistaken, it is whycantimeditate.com. And I'm sure that they can get in touch with you through the other web addresses that we also gave, which are mindfulness-psychotherapy.co.uk. And we will be linked primarily to the whycantimeditate.com website. I also want to extend to you an invitation. Should you find yourself in the Santa Barbara area, we'd love to have you in studio to continue our conversation.
Well, that's very kind of you. Oddly, my wife's best friend lived in Santa Barbara for many years, but now she's gone to Ashland in, where's that?
I don't know.
State nearby, I don't know. But thank you, that's very, very kind of you. That's terribly kind of you. I won't invite you to Bath unless you want to come with a very large umbrella.
I have no problem with that, none whatsoever. we matter of fact, when we went to Ireland our very first time in 2002, 2003, because it was over Christmas and New Year's holiday, we were out taking pictures of stone circles in different places in Ireland, and we had the cold wind and rain, and absolutely loved it. It was absolutely incredible, and I mean, I would do it again in a heartbeat because it was such an incredible experience. So yes, I would love to take you up on that as well. And also, I have three additional questions for you before we let you go that I ask my guests. And again, I thank you so much for spending so much time with us here on the program.
Thank you. That's kind. Thank you very much.
The first question is, who is Nigel Wellings?
I'm going to give you a Buddhist answer. Nigel Wellings doesn't really exist. He's just all causes and conditions coming together and falling apart. When I look inside to find Nigel Wellings, there's actually nothing there.
I like that. I like that very much. What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
Oh, I feel so upset about the cruelty of this world. And if I can just bring any goodness and kindness into it, that would be a good thing.
Hmm. And what is your life's purpose?
Oh, that's a difficult one. I kind of feel it's to serve, actually. I feel it's to, it goes back to the second question. I just feel that this world is just so full of pain. And to be able to bring something into it which helps diminish it is the most valuable thing I can do. I really do feel that. It terrifies me, this world, and it makes me weep when I see something which is good. That weeping tells me that there's a huge hunger inside of me for that.
And I couldn't agree with you more. I'm with you on that. We're on the same page in that regard. Nigel Wellings, thank you once again for sharing with us Why Can't I Meditate? How to get your mindfulness practice on track. It's been great talking with you here on the program, and we do look forward to hopefully having you in studio one day or coming to your location there in Bath, England, and sitting down with a recorder and continuing our conversation. And again, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Good night to you.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We're giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love Talal.